This is the 18th day of 365 beautiful days that the Lord is making this year. And I am grateful to be here with you, with all of you, in this place, worshiping and learning together. It's a good day. I thought you'd like to know a little bit of the background about this event. The seminary offered free registration for SLT to about 1,500 of the current faculty, staff, and students here at the university and seminary. And about a third of you are here because of that offer. And on Monday night, our offer was to the entire Harrisonburg community for the keynote. And all of the first group also could come to any of the three keynotes with their EMU ID. It'll get even broader, though, when you go home and share the word about the podcasts, which are free for the keynotes, and they will be on the EMU website later this week. So please spread the word to your friends that they can listen to those. I'd like to think, Walter, that we were a little bit ahead of you in our narrative of sharing instead of our narrative of accumulation for this event. So there you go. And thank you also to those of you who did contribute money. You contributed to Walter's airline ticket and our other expenses, and we do appreciate that as well. So thank you. And now I want to thank a number of people who have made this event possible. They've worked hard and long for over a year when we first started planning. And so I'd like to say thank you. First is to Seminary Professor Joni Sankin, who led the worship planning team. She involved a lot of local ministers and local persons, as well as our seminary students, and I think that we need to give her our thanks. Second is our workshop leaders, who led us yesterday, and they will do a repeat performance today for you. The EMU Alumni Office and Advancement Division personnel assisted with our ushering, and they also provided our welcome reception and our alumni luncheon. University physical plant staff have set up and taken down and moved and done all kinds of things to keep us comfortable, and I'm appreciative to them. Our co-sponsor, Everence, made many individual aspects of this conference possible, and we listed those yesterday. We thank them. And our seminary office staff has been supportive throughout this whole time of planning, and especially this week with a lot of details. Joanna, Beverly, and Beth need to be congratulated and thanked for that. Dean Michael King and Associate Dean Lonnie Yoder, as well as the entire planning team, spent a lot of time and thought preparing for this time, and I hope that that has come across to you. So for all of these people, let's show our appreciation. It has been our pleasure to host you here. Please return often. We hope that God will guide your thinking and your acting and the growing of your soul because you have been here. Thank you. Michael?
Linda is usually great with details, but a glaring omission. The director of School for Leadership Training was not thanked. And I just want to borrow from Walter and making sure Linda gets thanked. I just loved what happened when Walter first met Linda. He realized that this was Linda Alley, and he spread open his arms and he said, "It's Wonder Woman." Keep it brief, Linda, but I hope that conveys. We are going to continue appreciatively within the flow of School for Leadership Training 2012, but I do want to give you a preview of 2013. You may already have sought it out in your registration materials, but to highlight, we're going to be focusing on imagining church as healing space, which is the theme for 2013 SLT, and it's in the planning stages. Those among us seeking hope as we carry chronic effects of mental illness, suicide, and grief must be compassionately named and heard. The roles of the faith community, professional supporters, and of each of us in holding and healing such wounds, whether our own or those of persons we love, will be explored in a variety of practical, candid, and hope-inspiring ways. Leadership for this event will include several keynote speakers and many workshop leaders who bring expertise in holding faith and brokenness in tension. So we invite you to plan to register early, beginning in October 2012 of this year, to be part of this hearing, holding, and healing event. We are still in 2012, and we want to shortly hear a few words from Larry Miller, who is the leader of Everence Financial. And I want to highlight again, as we have in various ways, and Linda just did, that Everence is co-sponsor, and also I would give Everence tremendous credit for having catalyzed the conversations that led us here. I really don't see exactly how we would have arrived here without Everence and the moves that were made by Everence to initiate these conversations. So special thanks to Everence Financial and to all of you, Larry. And just a word on who Larry is. Larry has 36 years of experience in the retail banking and financial services industry. Before joining Everence in 2007, he served as president and CEO of Mennonite Financial Federal Credit Union for 16 years. And I believe it would have been during that period that I formed my key physical sense of your location, Larry. For a number of years, Larry and I both worked in the Mennonite Publishing House building in Scottsdale, and Larry would be in the corner office on the first floor, and I would go past there up to my Herald Press office on the second floor. So I am catching up with the fact that you are now at Everence. You served previously as vice president of Hawkeye Bank and Trust, Mount Pleasant, Iowa, and as president, did I hear, every time. I never understood this before, but you know, Lonnie Yoder, associate dean, Iowa, every time, Iowa just, what is it, Larry? You'll have to share. And as president and CEO of two federal land bank associations, also in Iowa. Larry attended Heston College in Heston, Kansas, is a graduate of Iowa State University, and graduated from Iowa Mennonite High School, or Mennonite School. Larry is active in the church community and serves as chair of the church board at College Mennonite Church. And we know Indiana is nowhere near like Iowa, but at least you are doing important things there. Larry, we welcome hearing from you.
You know, thanks a lot, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, being from Iowa, you know, it's kind of like the story of you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. You know, right, Lonnie? So, Everence has been extremely pleased to collaborate with the seminary, with the university, and with the local media chapter in making this event possible. And I am pleased that each of you have chosen to be here. You know, we are willing to also collaborate with your congregation and with your area conference through our network of representatives and advisors to do stewardship education and financial planning in your congregation and with your members. You know, we are a team of about 400 people at Everence. You know, financial organizations like Everence like to talk about their assets. You know, we're $2 billion in assets and all those things. But you know, our number one asset is our people and our members, the people that we serve. And some of our representatives have been here these days, and I'm going to ask them to stand up real quick so you can see who they are. And if you need to, yes. And okay, there's a few of them that aren't here. I know that Joe Lapp is down talking to students at the high school right now. So anyway, if you have some things you want to talk to us about, why there's a few of us around here. You know, many of our members, many of you are members of Everence, and you participate in our services. Many of you participate in Mennonite Retirement Trust, which is the Mennonite Church USA pension program administered by Everence. Many of you participate in insurance and health programs, investments, banking, and charitable services. And some of you are future members, and we look forward to you joining Everence, so we can serve your needs as well. I just want to thank each of you for your business and say that I appreciate very much your participation in this program of the church. I'm delighted to see that you as congregation leaders are here talking about faith and money. You know, I think it was Lynn Miller, who's one of our former stewardship education directors at Everence, who used to say there's two things we can't talk about in the church. One is money and the other is sex. And so I'm glad that we're here and able to talk about money. And Dr. Brueggemann, I don't know if you're going to talk about sex or not today, but but we appreciate what you've been saying about money. Having this discussion about money and is one that is very needed, because these are the challenges that our church members are dealing with daily, and many of our congregations and institutions are also struggling with these kinds of issues. So being able to discuss finances as an issue within the church is extremely important, and I'm pleased to see that that's happening here, and I hope that each of us can go back to our congregations with a sense of empowerment to continue this conversation. I want you to know that we at Everence are willing to come alongside you with resources and help you and be a part of that conversation in whatever ways we can be helpful to you. So thank you very much for coming. I appreciate that each of you are here and attended this conference.
Thank you so much, Larry. I have faced a few complexities in the last 24 hours as a seminary dean, and where's Irvin? There's Irvin. I was very tempted to call Irvin up and say, Irvin, you know, you've got this peaceful life leading Mennonite Church USA. How about you just come back for a few days and run EMS? But I did see Irvin getting his exercise this morning, and I took pity on him. Enjoy your current role. I also, if I'm not mistaken, understand that our Dr. Walter Brueggemann was once an academic dean. Do we have this correct? So we're going to invite you to do... No, I missed it.
He said, I'm sorry to say.
I'm sorry to say. Well, I was going to try to be extra kind to you. I'll debate where to go with that. We want to ask you to do, I've warned you a little bit, but not quite in full. I ask you to do just a little bit of extra work this morning. As the rubber hits the road right here among us on these issues of accumulation and abundance. So shortly I'm going to make a few announcements and comments, and you'll be free to ignore them or not. But if you would like to wade into a few and link them with your concerns, we'd love to hear from you. Just remember, you were once a dean. You know, I was a preacher too. Now, as we know, we have been wrestling with the tendency of Dr. Brueggemann to be reticent, and another one of our reticent persons who tends not to express strong opinions is our faculty member, Dr. Mark Thiessen-Nation. But Mark was once program director at London Mennonite Center. And during that era, London Mennonite Center sold books through the Metanoia bookstore. And Mark had the opportunity to review some Brueggemann books, urging readers to take Brueggemann's work seriously. And I thought, as part of priming the prompt for the extra work I'm asking our former dean to do, I would share just a few more words from Mark's commendation of Walter's work. Mark said, I don't know how many years ago this was, but it has to have been a while because Mark's been here for a while. Do you still stand by them, Mark? For those Christians who yearn for serious, biblically informed engagement with our contemporary world, there is no one more stimulating to read than Brueggemann. Is that obsequious, or are we still okay? I kind of go with it. The man rarely writes a boring page, nor speaks a very boring sermon. I added that. He is thoroughly knowledgeable as an Old Testament scholar, not to mention informed on theology, psychology, sociology, philosophy, and several other fields. And yet he writes with such verve that he is a joy to read. Amen. Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Walter. And now to get the work into your domain. Some of you probably noticed Chris Guile, who was panhandling as a form of street theater outside of Lehman Auditorium last night. And I don't know if Steve Carpenter is here. Are you here, Steve? Thank you, Steve. When I arrived, I came in as people who are leading these things do in the front, and I didn't see that Chris was here, and you alerted me to it, and that gave me opportunity to go and talk to Chris. So Chris and I spent about 15 minutes pondering our way through his concerns, and I enlisted his thoughts on if you're trying to pay for an event with a lot of costs and logistical complexities, and those of you mostly who are here, unless you're EMU freeloaders, but we love you, have paid good money to be part of these events, and your registration fees, if I'm not mistaken, included $25 per night. So we were trying to find a way to be fair to everybody. And Chris and I pondered that, and he heard me respectfully, and his concern was that the gospel of Jesus Christ is something that is offered out of abundance, and here we are charging $25 a head to get into a person he very much wanted to hear, which was Walter Brueggemann. And he stressed that he was a fan of Walter's, and does charging for this really work? We concluded that discussion with a holy embrace, and I think we both felt that way. And then later in the evening, I heard that a person who has been meaningfully involved in helping to shape the worship events was very concerned about charging tonight, because tonight, as we heard from Walter and from those involved in the service, we will be celebrating the abundant love of Christ poured out through communion. And how does it fit to charge for communion? This was when I nearly called Irvin. I don't know if Lauren's here. Is Lauren here? Lauren's here. I knew Irvin was off the payroll, so I called Lauren. And we did agree that we needed to somehow take seriously. We're right in the thick. This is where you have work to do, Walter. We're right in the thick of pondering this very agenda. And surely it means something that Chris and this other person are trying to find their way out of conscience and soul through the nitty-gritty details of how we do this gospel journey. So the best we could come up with was that we are going to turn tonight's event into a free will donation. And that means that those of you who paid, and some other people have the choice of not paying. Now, as I talked to Chris about this, I just had this eerie sense. And I told him this. I said, this feels to me like we are right smack in the middle of the parable of Jesus of the workers who come at different times of the day. And they all get paid the same. Thank you, Mary. But we have to pay for your salary. It gets... I'm with you. But this is why we need Walter to come up here shortly. So that's what we're in the thick of. You don't have to buy it, but it feels to me like we are precisely in the middle of the gospel, in the middle of a parable, trying to find our way through the nitty-gritties. And I do fear that that God is chuckling a little bit. Next comment I would like to note is awareness, because some of you have shared it with me, that there is a tendency of persons of my gender and color, or sometimes called white males, to be particularly present in conversations. I've become very aware as a dean presiding for the first time over a faculty search process from the dean's side as opposed to the hiree side, that even as I feel quite passionate about diversity at EMS, building a diverse candidate pool is really hard, much harder than I understood. And that has only alerted me and sensitized me to the reality that there are forces that make it easier for me to speak than for others to speak. So I just want to name that right here this morning as we move toward a time of conversation with Walter and give a special invitation to those of you who are not white guys, to be heard. We do need to hear from you. The church has a long way to go in recognizing that in Christ there is neither male nor female, different races and colors and so forth, and I hope we can experience a piece of that here this morning. So there's another piece of work for you if you want to comment on it. I will not dare to presume to know what gender or color you are. Final one, then it's off to you, Walter. You and I first got to know each other by email because I had the privilege of asking you to write a foreword to a book of sermons by Jim Longacre called Like Those Who Dream, and Jim, who was pastor at Salford Mennonite Church, where I've been a long attender, was very influenced by your thinking. And so you kindly agreed to write that foreword. And then comes the problem of revenue, profit, and soul. And this afternoon at lunch, I'm going to present on business with soul. And I'm going to make the case, and I'm now going to offer you the chance to demolish it so that I can just have my lunch and tell people I don't know what else to say. What I want to suggest is, in a situation like the publishing work that drew you into connection with me, of course, we hope there's some profit, because if there's no profit, if there's no ultimate more abundance than costs, we don't go on. And my proposal is that in this narrative of capitalist accumulation, which my business has operated in, we do need to generate the profit to support the soul, to support narratives such as Jim's of abundance. So I wish to hear whether you might do a little work with that issue of linking what you've been preaching with the ways we have to find our path through capitalism. I think that's enough. That should give you more than enough to chew on. We have a little more than half an hour. You take it where you wish, but we'll also invite feedback.
Well, after I go home, I will basically remember two things. I will remember having worshiped with you, and secondly, having a quail. And I want to say, Larry, that I'm sorry I'm not from Iowa. I am from Missouri. And when I was a child, I remember that a non-Mennonite family moved south from Iowa to Missouri and improved both populations. I am 78 years old, and when you get to be 78 years old, you don't have to think about any of these problems anymore. They belong to young people. I think your decision about a free Eucharist for which some have paid is exactly the right decision. Nicholas Waldersdorf, who you may know as a great Reformed theologian, he's really hot on justice questions now, and he has a book that is sort of about the Epistle to the Romans, in which he is raising the question, is God unjust to freely forgive people in the book of Romans? And he appeals to that parable by saying, God is completely just in doing that, because God kept God's fair agreement with the people who came to work early and was free to do what he wanted to otherwise, so he didn't violate any commitments to anybody. What you suggested to me about that question of the Eucharist and about having capital to publish is that our walk is always much more complicated than our talk. It just is. But I don't think that we ought to back off, for that reason, that we should back off from our clear, unambiguous talk, even though we know our walk can't be as clean as our talk, because our unambiguous talk works to keep us honest about our ambiguous walk. And I think we got to do both of those things, and I see you doing that very well, and I'm glad to be seated in the front row with you. So, good. My purpose on the last two nights about the talk and not the walk is to try to sharply as I could show that these two narratives of accumulation and gratitude deeply contradict each other, and even though we recognize that when it comes to our walk we move in and out. And I think the truth of our life is that we don't want to choose between those two narratives, but we want to juggle and hope no one catches us at it. But it's important that we know that about us. So thank you for your wisdom. Well, that's all I have to say, so maybe you have something to say by way of question or comment or probe about what we've been trying to talk about.
Probably clear, but if you come to the microphone, then it's probably not.
My name is Ruth Stolzfus Jost, and I was struck by your by your words last night about the assurance of abundance and the need for us to just understand that. And it seems strange to me that we've come this far in this conference without seeming to refer to the fact that we're living in a time when there's been an Arab uprising and when there are tens of thousands of people that have been out on the streets in this country, too, who've been saying, you know, there is enough for the 99% if we're sharing and organizing things adequately. So I'm concerned that we can have this larger group of people having the discussions we're having, but I noticed that we were careful after having referred to the Tea Party mentality in negative terms to balance that by saying, you know, that Barack Obama has done some very negative things, which indeed he has. And I'm concerned that we end up in a place where we're just too pure to, you know, to work together with anybody doing anything, whereas in fact we have some tremendous tools. We're in Jefferson's Virginia here, and we have a Declaration of Independence that a lot of Occupy people are looking at, saying, if it isn't serving the people, you alter or abolish it. And, you know, I'm concerned that I guess that being partisan is, or being seen as partisan, might be a risk that I should take and that we should take. And that if we're in a situation, I don't care which party is doing things that are trying to make things better for, you know, for the poor and working people of this country. But if there is a party that is trying to do that, making mistakes and in an uphill battle and definitely not being the Messiah, I think we still owe it to God and to our neighbors to do what we can with the people who are trying to bring about some justice that's going to be possible in our society. And I don't think we are addressing that dilemma. I find that as part of our local Occupy, I think I've become, in a sense, newly patriotic in a way that I never, you know, quite would admit to before. But we have some interesting tools here in this country that a lot of other people don't have and that we can be using. And I'm just concerned that are we willing to do things, even if it gets us painted as being partisan and political. If that's the cross to bear, maybe that's what we ought to bear, because we could be getting a lot of things done that I think I don't know, just like your comments on that.
Well, thank you for that comment, and I agree with you completely. I do not think it is so dark that all cats are black. I think you can distinguish between the cats and the cool cats. And the test case for me is, what kind of Supreme Court justice would be appointed by different kinds of leadership? And I think we've about handed the courts over to the plutocracy. And I think that partisan engagement is really important. And that kind of advocacy, while we are aware that political action is a series of compromises, and as I said, our walk is never as innocent as our talk, but we have to walk. And so if I get your point, I agree with that completely, and therefore advocacy among options that are not perfect but are better than some other option really requires us to be actively engaged. So thank you for that. And I did not mean when I said, Barack Obama too, I did not mean to say I think that they're all alike about this. I believe that government has a terribly important regulatory function to protect the vulnerable from the predator class. And I think that the attempt of people to reduce the government to a size of a bathtub, I think that's that tax pledge author, I can't think of his name, Grover, you know, I think it's horrendous, and I think it needs to be resisted in every active way that we can muster and think about. So thank you for that. Yeah.
My name is Jeff Lundblad, old Mennonite name. I'm joking. As the gentleman from Everance stood up and talked about financial planning, I was hearing a dissonance in my spirit between the theology of abundance and the theology or the idea of financial planning. Just a little bit. There's a tension there between accumulating for the future and this theology of abundance. So as we talk about navigating this path, we tiptoe through the tulips. Where would you place the paving stones to help us navigate when we are crossing those lines?
So you're asking about abundance and planning?
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me, and I don't think it's clean and pure, but our financial planning cannot be private and individualistic. That we have to plan for our personal and family security amid the well-being of the common good. And I think that what gets distorted is when we think we can do private family planning as though there were nobody else out there. But I don't think that's the only kind of planning that can take place. So I don't see that being a contradiction. I think it requires hard work, and it requires hard work outside the common assumptions of our society. But I don't think it's a contradiction. If I've missed the point, come back at it.
I just see this idea that of building and saving for the future, and in general, when we're working with financial planning, it tends to be in excess of maybe what we really truly need at the most basic level of our lives. We want to retire in comfort.
Yep.
And I sometimes wonder if that ignores some of the communal responsibility for care of this as we age, and within that context. So I'm trying to get a sense for how to set a balance as pastor to navigate how we encourage our people to be responsible with their funds now towards an eye of the future. So I guess I hear what you're saying.
What comes to mind as you talk is the narrative of Ananias and Sapphira in the book of Acts, where they withheld private funds from the common good of the church. And if I recall that narrative in Acts, it says that you can hear the footsteps of the people that carry their bodies out, because if you do that, you're going to die. The word of the Lord, thanks be to God.
So drawing back to the first night story, how big is the silo?
So
drawing back to the first night story, then we have to determine how large of a silo is not going to be offensive to God.
That's correct. That's exactly right. Yeah.
I'm Al.
What I think we have to work on is that private individualism is the great American heresy. And it leads to death. I'm reading a book now on the aging process. I'm paying great attention to that. The book is entitled Never Say Die. And the argument of the book is that a few people are going to retire to safety and well-being and long health is an illusion. And what we need are public policies for the common good, that there finally is no private well-being. And that's very upstream, but that is the claim of the gospel. And we have to connect that precisely with the planning process. So I think what the Mennonites ought to do is to convene meetings of lawyers who write people's wills, et cetera, et cetera. Sir.
Thank you, Al Mass from Walnut Creek Mennonite in Ohio. Just since this conversation, this triggered in my mind, did Ananias and Sapphira die because they didn't share their wealth or because they pretended to give it all? And also, I thought of the narrative. Your talks have been very provocative, very, very heart-searching. The story, the narrative of Pharaoh, and he was portrayed as a very greedy man. He took their wealth. He provided food, but then he took their land. He took their animals. And they had nothing except themselves, and they became slaves. But I find interesting as you read on in that scripture that when the famine was ended, Joseph said, "Here, I'm going to give you seed. I'm going to rent you the land free. And you just plant the seed, whatever grows, you harvest it, and all I ask is give me 20%, you keep the rest." Oh, you have any comment? I have a follow-up question, then, if you don't mind your reflection on that. Does that mean that Pharaoh was really just greedy, or they said, we're glad to serve you, you saved our lives?
Well, he made them tenant farmers.
Sure.
He made them precarious renters. So I don't think that was a very good economic solution. What he did was to leverage food to become the sole owner of land. The only land he didn't own was the land of the priests.
Okay, just a thought. I wanted to.
Yeah.
Now a follow-up question.
I can remember working in the hayfields, where the owner of the hayfield got every fifth bale of hay. Same deal, but that of course doesn't make it any better just because it's the same deal.
I guess I like to believe that the system, the free enterprise system, was set up and it worked when it was not confused and by greed and corruption. And then I'm just thinking, after pondering this, what you said, maybe the challenge for the church is to prove that it can work.
Well, it could be. I don't think that the church has a particular alliance toward any economic system, nor in a particular adversarial position toward any economic system. Okay. So what the churches in Eastern Europe said that many of the churches said their task is to insist that communist regimes be faithful to their own commitments. And maybe what you're saying is that in a capitalist society, we need to be insisting that capitalism be practiced honestly and in neighborly ways.
Yeah, free enterprise.
Yeah.
We're in a fallen world.
Yeah.
And maybe as believers, the challenge is to help to prove that it can.
But it appears to me that in our capitalist system now, with huge corporate conglomerates, governmental regulation is indispensable to keep the big ones from eating up the little ones.
Okay.
That requires more than goodwill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what I think.
Thank you. Just a follow-up question briefly. I and maybe some others, just curious if you could help understand the value and the purpose of profanity and colorful language in your discourses.
Oh, I don't know. I probably learned that from Stanley Hauerwas, who is so much influenced by the Mennonites.
Thank you.
I don't know, and if that's offensive, why I regret it, I regret doing it then. I think that my strategic intention is to try to break the cocoon of niceness around our discourse of faith. That's what I think. Where was the speaker? Are you from Ohio? Well, I want to tell you and Larry that, you know, the Midwestern states don't get much noticed. So there was a woman from the Midwest at a dinner party in Boston, and her host said, "Where do you come from?" She said, "Iowa." He said, "Oh, my dear, here we pronounce it Ohio."
I'm Phil Showers. I'm a United Methodist minister who's a seminarian here at Eastern Mennonites. So I'm also influenced by Stanley Hauerwas and the Mennonites, but I will keep my comments civil if I can. I would like to ask you to look at salvation theology in light of these scriptures that you've been talking about, because after all, I think salvation is our ultimate objective. And when you look at the entire chapter 47 there, you find that it was the Egyptians and Canaanites who were becoming slaves because of this great accumulation of wealth by Pharaoh. Yet the Israelites benefited from insider trading and crony capitalism. It wasn't until in the last chapter of Genesis, when Joseph's brothers willingly became his slaves to help cover up their sin and concoct a lie, that they actually became slaves to Joseph. And I guess what was Joseph became Pharaoh's. And then in the Exodus, when God redeemed his people as their next of kin, the only Egyptians that were liberated were those ones like Edward G. Robinson that followed Charlton Heston out of Egypt, because I guess they weren't God's people. And so then how do you look at this narrative in terms of salvation, especially those folks who anticipate universal salvation, when salvation may be the ultimate corporate, not the individual act?
Well, I can tell you where the front edge of my thinking is, but I'm very unsettled about it. You may know the rabbinic story that when Moses came up out of the waters of emancipation, there was God sitting there weeping. And Moses said to God, "This is a great day of liberation. What are you crying about?" And God said, "I am crying for my Egyptian children who have drowned." So I am at the edge of thinking that the notion of being God's chosen people is a very pernicious notion. That is the root cause of a lot of problems in the world that run all the way from the contemporary state of Israel to the contemporary mindset of the United States as God's most recently chosen people. The problem with my saying that is that the implication is, if one must critique chosen people, then one must run the risk of thinking again about the chosenness of a Messiah on whom we've staked our lives. And when you go down that path, everything unravels. So I am thinking those thoughts, and I don't know what to do with them. You know, the nice liberal way of handling that is say, no, no, chosen for service. But God, I can never remember that. So I think most families with more than one sibling have a chosen child. I have two sons, and I know that we all three know who the chosen son is. It just wells up. And it is enormously destructive. So what you can see in the book of Genesis, even before you get to Joseph, scholars are now writing much about Jacob the trickster, who is always seducing and deceiving, but he's got a free ride because he's the chosen son. And it goes all the way through. So, is the notion of a chosen people a category mistake? And the text that I, when I think these thoughts, the text I hold on to by my fingernails is at the end of Isaiah 19. Where it says, behold, the days are coming. That means it's very sure, but we don't know when. When God will say, this is incredible, blessed be Egypt, my people, blessed be Assyria, the work of my hands, and blessed be Israel, my inheritance, which means God has many chosen peoples. Now, I haven't checked this, but an Old Testament scholar told me recently that the Septuagint, the Greek translation, has inserted a preposition that said, blessed be my people in Egypt and my people in Assyria, which means they took it all back for ourselves. So I think we have huge thinking about that. And I think the immediate pastoral question really is U.S. chauvinism, that in our chosenness as the leader of the free world and manifest destiny and I don't know what all, we are free to send our power around the world everywhere to get our markets and our resources and our oil, because surely it must all belong to us. I reviewed a book for the Christian Century not long ago about Teddy Roosevelt's imperialism, and there's a picture in that book of U.S. soldiers waterboarding, is that the word? Water, torture? Waterboarding Filipinos in 1901, before we claimed the Philippines. So the weight of thinking that we are the chosen people in the world, I believe, is in continuity with what you point out in the biblical text. Now, come back at that if you want to.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of the church being the new Israel. And as the body of Christ in the world today, it is through Christ that salvation is made available to the entire world.
Yep.
Sadly, the entire world won't take advantage of that, but it is being made available to that. And so I was looking at more in the salvation theology, since the Exodus is such a major portion of that.
Yep.
The fact that the Egyptians actually suffered pretty horrible in that event as their firstborns died so that the Israelites might be liberated.
Yep.
And so that's what I was trying to make, that connection, not so much the political aspect today as much as how do we then communicate a sound salvation theology where we do recognize we have a role as the followers of Jesus today to spread his gospel, but to do it also with grace, that it's not because we are good, but because God is gracious that this opportunity is available to you.
Yeah.
To walk out with us.
And maybe a recognition that while the church has a missional responsibility, the church does not have a monopoly, and that God has many agents and many ways in the world except us and our way. So what is most pernicious about the doctrine of election is the assumption of monopoly.
Well, sir, you have to keep in mind, I'm a Methodist, and so we don't believe in predestination.
Good enough.
I'm Carmen Schrockhurst. I co-pastor with my husband, Luke, at Emmanuel Mennonite Church, which is a little tiny church on the edge of Harrisonburg surrounded by government housing. So a lot of the questions about the 1% and the 99% ring very true in our neighborhood. I also wear the hat of teaching part-time in the Bible department at EMU to the undergraduates. So I have sort of two commercial messages growing out of those hats that I wear. I'm teaching a class this semester on the congregation and youth ministry. And as I'm reading books, getting ready for that, I'm just overwhelmed by studies that are showing what's happening to the youth in this country. I thought I understood that as a parent, but I clearly didn't. And it's just really important that we as pastors and anyone working with youth understand that we have a generation that's feeling completely abandoned. And I'm using a textbook called Hurt 2.0. The author is Chap Clark, and I want to invite all of you to go home and have your youth ministers and pastors and parents read this. Because if we're talking about assets and abundance and scarcity, the youth and young adults are the greatest asset that the church has right now, but what they're seeing is a generation of adults with a pretty mediocre, lukewarm faith, so it doesn't look very inviting or compelling to them. And I think a lot of the lukewarmness is so connected to what we're talking about here. We've gotten so caught up in how to survive economically and how to provide for the future that we aren't looking at the messages we're conveying. So that's my one commercial message. The other thing is, we have a 23-year-old daughter living in Indonesia in a one-room concrete block house on top of a river of trash. And so when we talk about the struggle of the pyramid in this country, which is incredibly real, and I don't want to minimize what that means, I just want to make sure we remember to look at our pyramid within the pyramid of the whole world and all the world's resources. And how do we work at faithfulness here but not stay completely focused on here? Which ties into what you were just saying.
Well, clearly the force of the U.S. pyramid, the economic force of the U.S. pyramid, extends well beyond the U.S. To feed the plutocracy everywhere in the world. Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Brueggemann. I told my daughter that you're my theological rock star. And she's 21, and I got her to go listen to you last night. And we were walking back to the dorms, and she said, "He's really cool." And I said, We both agreed that part of it was that you had flowering language that invited her in, I think, to some of that realness. And that goes on Carmen's comment about we need to wake up to our kids. I'm taking a little bit different tact about the economy that we are talking about. If we're trying to stay in this narrative of abundance, how do we, the church, remain in that narrative and not fall back into a narrative of scarcity when we are in conflict together?
When we're in conflict
yes, we're tempted to fall back into the fearful narrative of scarcity in which we judge those who are in or out, right or wrong. And of course, you know that the Mennonites never have conflict, so.
I've heard that.
Just in case, yeah.
Well, I don't know the answer to those questions. I think that dramatically, the answer is the Eucharist. The Eucharist is the dramatic performance of abundant bread, and nobody in the church owns the bakery. It's not our bread. And the bread is passed out indiscriminately to the whole body. Now, I know it doesn't work that easily, but what that ought to do, what that can possibly do, is to make all of our disagreements penultimate. Behind all of our disagreements, there is this abundance that envelops us all. But when we fail to celebrate that abundance that envelops us all, we get seduced into thinking that our disagreements are ultimate, and we set it up as a profound win-lose struggle, when in fact our winning or losing is a matter of proximate importance, but not ultimate importance. And therefore, we ought to fight differently. Does that make any sense?
That does. You rock, as my daughter would say.
I'll tell you what I wish. I wish I could walk as good as I talk.
Final one here, and then we will bring it to a close. Actually, okay, are you trying to get up, Nick?
I am, but...
Can you both keep it short?
Yes.
Okay, and then we'll follow up.
The problem is brevity on this end.
It's a matter of whether Walter can keep it short.
We'll trust you.
Joel Miller, white male, pastor of Cincinnati Mennonite Fellowship. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the meaning and role of miracle. Two of the biblical stories you cited yesterday were the story of Elisha, the woman who's was going to lose her home, and the creation of the wine or the oil to sell to pay for that, and then the feeding of the 5,000. And 4,000. Very real problems of foreclosure and hunger, in which the biblical solution is miracle, which for us modern contemporary problem solvers, there's something slightly dissatisfactory about real problems that seem to have unreal solutions with the faith of, we want to ask how does this actually get solved, and we're not given that in the story. So how do we understand miracle, and how does that inform us?
When you locate what we call miracle in the narrative of accumulation, which means enlightenment rationality, miracle then becomes a violation of natural law, right?
Right.
And it's fanciful and absurd and not credible. But what we have to do is to read these transformative deeds not in the narrative of accumulation, but in the narrative of abundance. And then the Bible does not call them miracles. The Bible calls them signs and wonders of the transformative power of God, who is the primary character in the narrative of abundance. So from the outside, those stories look silly. But we are not to receive them from the outside. We are participants in the narrative of abundance. And everybody knows that at the center of the narrative of abundance is the God who works abundance. So what we have to argue is that the narrative of accumulation is no place to stand if you want to understand what's going on in the world. My wife, a long time ago, was a chaplain in an eye hospital. People had eye surgery. And she went from room to room praying. And her experience over and over is that white male business guys who had eye surgery, she would say, "Do you want me to pray?" And their answer was, "I don't mind if you want to. Won't bother me." But every once in a while, there was eye surgery conducted on a poor black woman who said, "Oh, yes, 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 please." And when she finished praying, the person in bed continued the prayer, because those persons had learned long ago that they were going to get killed by the narrative of accumulation. And so insofar as they were able, they put their lives down in the narrative of wondrous abundance. Am I making any sense to you?
Yes, yeah.
So the purpose of biblical teaching and interpretation and proclamation is to keep making the case that the narrative of abundance is the true story of our life, and the narrative of accumulation is a fraud that cannot deliver life.
Yeah, thank you.
And I, you know, I think those of us who are highly educated and relatively affluent and so on, we keep wanting to take bits and pieces of the faith and fit them in to the narrative of accumulation. But it doesn't work. It doesn't compute. That's what I think. So I think that the meeting where we advocate this narrative is like a 12-step program. And you know what happens if you don't go to AA, you fall off the wagon back into your addiction. If you don't go to the meeting where the narrative of abundance is advocated, you will fall back into the addiction of accumulation, where nothing computes. That's what I think.
One more voice. Thank you for coming. And Nick, I did see you give up your slot. Thank you.
We welcome you.
Thank you very much for hearing a few more questions. I know part of the effect of privilege versus lack of privilege is self-confidence versus timidity. And so the extra time is helping to overcome that. My name is Maria Beiler, and I work in a congregation that's largely immigrant. And I am struck by how far down into poverty the narrative of accumulation goes. And that in poverty, it takes even more energy and even more focus to get anything in that narrative. And that's compounded in my congregation by the need to also send money home to the home country to support people who are depending on you, on your work here. And I think the walk of the narrative of abundance looks different in that context than it does in the situation of me and many people here of comfort. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I do think that the narrative of accumulation is enormously powerful all the way up and down the pyramid in our society. So the poorest people subscribe to it in the hope that we'll also get there someday, without recognizing that the rules of the game are rigged against people at the bottom moving up very far. There is an occasional breakthrough, but the occasional breakthrough is the rule, is the exception to the rule that keeps the rest of us believing. But it isn't true. That's what I think.
Thank you.
Walter, there might be two people or, I don't know, 200 who disagree with one or two things you said. But you have my spine tingling. I suspect you have many spines tingling. And that is partly credit to you because you are a wonderful resource. It's also credit to you as a channel of the Holy Spirit. Thank you. You're now dismissed into the abundance of break time, and then you'll be free to follow your schedules as currently listed. Thank you all.